Hello, and welcome to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is honored to have with us one of my favorite authors, A.J. Pierce, whose new book is Mrs. Porter Calling. I hope I got that title right. I keep reversing it.
Absolutely. Hello.
Before we begin, I'd like to let those tuning in know the Poison Pen does have copies of all of AJ's books, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. Just give us a call at the Poison Pen Bookstore or go online. Now, I would like to welcome AJ Pierce.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And hello, everyone. I can't see you, but thank you for coming. It's really kind of you.
Thank you. My first question for you is, I'm always fascinated by authors because they normally don't spring out of the head of Zeus like Athena. They have a backstory. So can you tell us a little bit about who AJ was before you became a published author?
Yes, I'll keep it short because it's not terribly interesting, actually. I used to work in marketing and fairly commercial roles. I grew up in the south of England, in a village, and with my mum and my dad and my brother, and was quite a booky kid. I loved books, loved pony books. I didn't have my own horse, so I used to dream of having one, and I used to make up stories, and I used to run an imaginary riding school for a while, which was very successful, and I ran an imaginary school. I was quite nerdy, I think, and I wrote what would now be called fan fiction a little bit in my teens. We had in the 80s, we had a sci-fi series on the BBC called Blake 7, which we used to watch. And I used to write my version of that, where me and my friends would time travel, essentially so that we could meet the Beatles. That was the whole point of writing these things. And then I stopped writing. I went to college. I studied American studies. I was lucky enough to go to Northwestern for a year, which was the most amazing year to get to be in the States. And then had quite a normal sort of working life until, and this makes me sound super old, until they invented emails. And I realized I liked, you know, when I wrote to people, just sent an email, I liked editing it. I liked just making things sound a bit better. And just for a hobby, one day I Googled writing courses and went on a four-day writing course at an organization we have called Arvon over here, and boom, life-changing. It was, I just discovered a world where people were, I'd been in quite a corporate world, which was great, but I discovered in writing people were friendly and supportive and said, it's all right, you can be creative, you don't have to pretend, you know, you don't have to be worried about looking like you're trying too hard. And that's when I started writing. And then I end up here, which is extraordinary.
Well, your first book, would it be correct to say that we can blame it on a purchase on eBay, dear Mrs. Bird?
Yes. I mean, I can blame most of my house on eBay, I think, actually. But I was time wasting, which is one of my favorite things. And I found this old magazine, a weekly women's magazine from 1939, just before the war started. And it was another light bulb moment. I'd been writing as a hobby for a while, but as soon as I opened it, it was a whole world that had opened, but through something I was really familiar with, because the content of women's magazines hasn't changed that much in terms of there's fashion and beauty and stories and opinions and of course the problem page and what we call agony aunts here and advice columnists, as you guys would say. And that of everything was the thing that grabbed my attention, that there were some of the problems are very old fashioned and others were exactly the same as the ones we have now, you know, love and mothers and fathers and partners and money and all the troubles we still have were exactly the same. So I started collecting magazines, and that's where Dear Mrs. Bird came from. I knew I wanted to base something in a women's magazine. And then the whole idea of having a young, modern, rather idealistic journalist clashing against a very old-fashioned one came when I bought a volume of magazines from, I think, the 1890s, and realized that they were, the advice back in the 1890s was very stern, very very tough. And the problems then, by 1943-44, the problems were pregnancy outside of marriage, or falling in love with the wrong chap, affairs, quite, you know, big deal, big scary problems. And whereas rather sweetly, the ones that they would print, at least in the 1890s, were more, one, for example, if I like a chap I know in the village, is it all right for me to say hello to him, or should I wait for my father to introduce us first? And that's such an enormous change in 50 years. And I thought that's my story.
Your first book introduces us to Emmy Lake. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
I'd love to. Emmy's been in my head for about 10 or 12 years now. So she's very real. They're all very real. And Emmy starts off in the first book as a naive young woman, but a good-hearted one. And she wants to be a war journalist. And in Britain in the war, it was pretty much impossible. There were perhaps one or two women got to be war journalists at that point. The American press was more broad-minded. And she accidentally gets a job working for a women's magazine. And she's snobby to start with. She thinks, well, this isn't proper war work. This is just silliness. She was exactly actually the sort of snob I hate, the sort of person who is snooty about women's magazines and all sorts of stuff like that. And she learns the whole series is about her realizing actually this is important, and the women are doing an incredibly important job to help win the war. And she is very modern for her time, and her backstory, I thought it was really important that was believable. So her dad is a GP, he's a doctor. So she's got this very upper middle class solidity. She's much loved, her mum and dad and her brother, that she's had a great background. So she has the confidence that goes with that. But I added to that a mum and a grandmother who had been in the women's suffrage movement. So there's a more bohemian political side to her family. And so she is brought up to believe that women, that everyone has a right to be heard, to be listened to. So I thought, if you have that slight kind of, that approach that everyone must have a voice, put together with confidence, now we have a young woman who has the audacity almost to secretly start sending letters, even though she has no qualifications. She's a bit of a bull in the china shop, but she means well. And what I've tried to do through the book so far is have her grow. So she's not still quite so headstrong. She's still passionate about stuff, but I couldn't have her continue to be the same person, because that would be irritating. So she's growing up, and by the time we meet her in the new one, she's earned her stripes. You know, she's got a lot. She has a lot to say and a lot of knowledge behind it.
What can you tell us about the new book, Mrs. Porter Calling?
Well, in Mrs. Porter Calling, we meet Emmy in 1943, when she is now a fully fledged advice columnist, and she's doing really well. She's really learnt her trade. She's advising women. She's a popular columnist. She and her team are keeping up with a lot of letters, huge amounts. They're busy, they're successful, everything is going really well. And then the owner of the magazine passes away, and his niece, the Honourable Cressida Porter, inherits the magazine. And she's everything the team aren't. Emmy and the team are hardworking and empathetic, and they care. Their readers are their family. It's very much a book about your chosen family, I think, whether they're friends that you've known and loved forever or strangers that you reach out to. And the Honourable Cressida Porter turns up, and she's posh and she's rich and she's privileged and totally entitled. And she arrives in a sort of a cloud of glamour. I don't know why I'm doing that, pretending I'm doing a cloud of glamour. She's impossibly glamorous. And she arrives and says, oh, I love everything. I won't change a thing. We're all wonderful. And then, of course, she decides to change everything, and she wants to change their magazine that is doing such a good job in the war effort. And she wants to turn it into her own personal scrapbook. So one of the main plots in the book is Emmy and her friends fighting to save the magazine that they and their readers love. And at the same time, there's the sort of domestic side of her life, where she and her best mate Bunty, who live in West London, their friend Thelma brings her kids to come and live with them all in a big house. And we follow their adventures as they try to give the children a normality of life. And I've had children in the books before, but this was a wonderful opportunity to really look at how children were responding and growing up during the Second World War. So that, I think, is, I hope I've managed that without spoilers.
You did. That's a wonderful job. And you did an excellent job with the children's characters in the book, because they seem very real to their time, very much children at that age. But you also show how children can step up in difficult circumstances. There's a couple points in the book where, you know, you're reaching the Kleenex because the children are saying things that are so much more mature than you expect them to be. But they had to be, because times were different.
Yes, well, thank you so much. I mean, the children in the book, George, Margaret, and Stan, they mean a lot to me. They're named, two of them are named after my parents, who I'm really lucky to still have around. And one of the lovely things about writing this series has been we've chatted about their childhood so much more over the last years that I've been writing the books. Mm-hmm. And that's a lovely way of putting the fact that also I am mining their every memory, their every recollection. You know, I send emails to my dad saying, Dad, what sweets could you get hold of? Mm-hmm. You know, did you have any pets? And they're very helpful. And I'm really lucky. I've been able to speak to quite a few, mostly women over the years, who've shared their recollections. And it's easy to get into a cliche, but there is a sort of an amazing spirit that, you know, these young people and these young children, they'd go to school and they carried on and they still had to sit their exams. And some days they'd go to school and some of the children wouldn't turn up, mm-hmm. you know, or their parents, they'd lost their parents. And they went through such enormous trauma, mm-hmm. But still they carried on. And I realized also that one of the things that we all, I think, try to do in times of trauma and difficulty is try to bring a normality, you know, whether it's still having a birthday party or still trying to have a night at the cinema or whatever it happens to be, whether it's now or then. That's what the grown-ups try to do in the book with the children. They go to London Zoo because the children want to see the animals, and they're disappointed that the elephants have been evacuated and have all this sort of, that's one of the sort of nice fun bits of the book. And it's just trying to show that the children were still children in extraordinary times.
One of the other things that I kind of learned, or you reinforced for me as a reader, was there's the idea to think of women's magazines as being these silly little fluffy publications that had no real purpose other than just maybe to entertain. But there was a real value to them, especially during World War II, and that comes up a lot in the books, especially in yours, cheerfully. What role did advice columnists help play in the war effort?
Well, they were really important. I mean, women's magazines over here were a huge part in a positive way of our propaganda as well. And the government did work with the editors of the magazines, because it was a very direct way to get to the women of Britain, and to both in terms of keeping their morale up and also on a practical level, when the government realized just how many hundreds of thousands of women they needed to go into war work, they brought the women's magazines on board. And I collect magazines. I have 800 or 900 magazines, most of which are from the era. And the careers advice every week. You know, do you want to go into armaments? Do you want to go into making parachutes? You know, what can you do? And then yours cheerfully, which is very much about young widows and young factory workers, the country needed the women to go to work, but hadn't really thought it through that, you know, they had children. It wasn't compulsory for mothers to work, but that rather ignored the fact that economically women had to work. So what happened to their children if they were working the night shift? And that was inspired by a wonderful woman I met several years ago who shared her memories and said that one of her earliest recollections was when she was about four and she was playing in the factory where her mum worked. And I said, "You were playing in a factory, that sounds awfully dangerous." And she said, "Well, yeah, but if mum couldn't get childcare, I had to go to work with her." And so the women's magazines became part of a campaign to try and get government-run nurseries. And you see quite a lot in the editorial of the weekly women's magazines during the war, the editors standing up for their readers and saying things like, "Give us more to do. Our readers are telling us that they have applied to go into the services or go into the factories and they haven't heard back 6 months later. You need them, get on with it." Or another one I remember was, "Our readers are in the services, but they're being given jobs where they're just, you know, making the tea. Give them more to do, they can do it. We're up for this. Come on, we can do this." And it's really strong, brave, proud stuff. And very inspiring. And almost everything in my books is inspired by either real people or the magazines and the issues that mattered to the readers. And equal pay, they talk about that. And in later on in the war, that the magazines will say, you know, "What are we going to do next?" I remember a problem from one reader saying, she was a biochemist or something, really clever, and she wanted to carry on working, but you weren't supposed to after you got married. And so really interesting issues. And then on the next page, there'll be a recipe for jam roly-poly, you know. So what's not to love about jam roly-poly? Along with career advice. So they were fantastically important.
Yeah, it's the counterpart in the US would be, I remember reading a book about how women who were pilots were limited to just flying the planes that would ferry supplies. They could not fly anything else because the military didn't want them in that position. So we underestimate women at our own risk, I think, whether it's in World War II or the present day.
Absolutely, absolutely.
One of the questions I have is, you write historical fiction, and I'm not a writer, but I imagine the challenge would be when doing historical fiction, especially, is how do you capture the real spirit of a time and a place authentically, but also make it accessible to readers today? How do you kind of find that balance as a writer?
Gosh, that's such a good question. I think I probably try not to think about it too much. Mm-hmm. I have a t-shirt with "Let me overthink that" written on the front of it, because that's my default place. I think it all comes down to characters, really. That I do my research. I try to get that right so that no one is jolted out of the period when they're reading it, saying, "Oh, ouch, that didn't happen." I try to get that right. So that's a practical thing. And I try to set the scenes as well as I can and use everything I can to understand what things looked like, what they smelt like. I use recipes from the time. If my characters go to a restaurant, I use the menu from that restaurant if I can get hold of it. There's a scene in the Savoy Hotel in Mrs. Porter Calling, and they were kind enough to send me a screenshot of a menu from 1943, so I knew exactly that my characters were eating what they were allowed under rationing, allowed to have. But I think in terms of making it accessible, it comes down to human emotion. I mean, I can only imagine, it's my job, I can only imagine or try to imagine what it must have been like. And thankfully, I think it's impossible to imagine what it's like to live through the Blitz, you know. But I try, and what I try to do is, in terms of the people in the books, understand how they feel about things, what they love, what means something to them, their fears, and try to make them the sort of people that if we picked them up out of the book and sat them next to us now, we would get on with them. You know, I think one of my favorite things is when readers say, I would love to sit down and have a cup of tea with Emmy and a chat, or go out for the evening with her and Bunty. I'm really chuffed when people say that. And I think, I hope that, you know, whether people were born 20 years ago or 100 years ago or 500 years ago, we all want to kind of live. I mean, I hate to sound like one of those signs people put up in their kitchen, you know, that says live, love and laugh, or dance like no one's watching. Turned into one of those. But that's what we want to, you know, mm-hmm. We want to have fun and to find people or find our friends or our family and be part of something. And I think it's trying to write about feelings that we can still relate to, even if it's in a time where, mercifully, we don't have any experience of that.
True. You really do an excellent job of it. One of the things you mentioned was a theme to all of the books is that of friendship. There's different relationships in the book, but friendship is one of the strongest ones. We sometimes don't see that in fiction, and it's important in all of our lives. Can you talk a little bit about friendship?
Yes, it's weird, isn't it? Because almost everyone I know people who are married or divorced or widowed or single or in all sorts of different setups. But the one thing all of them have is a friend, you know, and hopefully a best friend. But it's not written about in books it's not sort of represented as much as perhaps it could be. And I think it's really interesting because the relationship of friends is, it's not always straightforward. Sometimes it's complicated. Sometimes your lives go in different directions and then they come back again, or things get in the way. But they can be some of the longest relationships in your entire life. And I'm always inspired by my mum, who she's 91, and she and her best mate, Olive, have been friends for 80 years.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the most brilliant thing. And they still call each other. You know, they were both gutted when Rafa Nadal didn't play Wimbledon this year. And, you know, they still call each other and say, he's on the telly. And that's special. I mean, that's longer. It's a long relationship if we're very lucky. And it's one that we have no blood ties. We don't have to be polite to our friends because we don't have to see them at Christmas. We don't have a legal binding to them. There's the, you know, we have every reason and opportunity to stray away, but sometimes we don't, and I find that really interesting. And I'm very lucky. I have some amazing friends who I love dearly, so I love being able to write about those sorts of relationships, the ups and downs, and how you haul each other through the stinky times and then absolutely revel in the good times. Anyone watching is writing, honestly, I write about friends. It's just a joy to do.
Well, I'm not sure they could match you, but they could certainly try.
I bet you can.
Let's talk a little bit about, you've in previous interviews emphasized how lightness, I'm taking that in a broad sense, optimism, hope, is underrated in fiction. Why is it important that we have that in fiction? And as a counterpart to that, you can't have lightness without darkness. So how do you balance those elements in your novels?
I think the hopeful part of it is, I mean, the news is grim, isn't it? Mm-hmm. There are so many sad and frightening and worrying things going on in the world. And so to escape into a book which is probably why fantasy is doing so well now, you know, isn't it wonderful to just sometimes sit down with a book and just escape from everything? And I know for some people that will be a twisty thriller, which is full of scary stuff. Mm-hmm. But I like quite mostly to read books where I kind of think, yay, you know, it's everything's awful, but somehow a couple of them have got through, or, you know, everything's awful, but they still believe in each other or whatever they're fighting for. So I like to have hope in the books I write, because I actually find writing the tough bits and the sad bits really hard work. And sometimes, I know we were talking about this earlier before we came on air, but anyone who's read any of my books knows that quite often there are some really sad bits in them. And I'd like to apologize for that for anyone who's cried on a bus. And honestly, trust me, I am there with you. I am in tears when I'm writing that stuff. I hate doing horrid things to the characters and making them miserable in any way. But you have to, as you say, have that light and that darkness, because if I had my way, I would write page after page of jollies, you know, on everyone having. I mean, the new book starts with someone's birthday and they've managed to find some cake and they're tap dancing in the garden. And honestly, I would fill the whole book full of that stuff. But my editors will insist on a plot. So I think, yes, I try to balance it by having, we've always said, right from when I first was published, it's hurdles and larks. You know, there are fun bits that we can all kind of, yay, get some enjoyment from, but there have to be hurdles for them to get through, the characters to get through. And then there is the very, very practical point that you cannot set a book in the war unless you have times of trouble and fear and sorrow. Otherwise, this isn't a pantomime. This is, you know, these books are set in one of the most terrifying times in our history. And so you have to do justice to that time and to the people who I get to interview and who share their memories. I want to do justice to that and to my parents and and my grandparents and all the people who lived through it, you know, in my own peeny weeny way. I don't want to turn it into some kind of theme park. This is, you know, I try to make the books realistic and for them to reflect a very traumatic period in our history. So I try to balance them out, and then it is a very technical thing of the writing process, which is the weaving through the different plot lines to make it balance and make sure it's not all happy here and then really dreary for a few pages and then woohoo, you know, it can't be clunky. It's a roller coaster, but I hope smooth.
It is. And for anyone who has not read your books, I can guarantee them that they will be happy at the end. There may be some hurdles along the way, but at least you don't reach the end and think that was not worth it.
I hope so. I hope they feel good. I it sounds odd to say feel good novels set during a war, but I hope that isn't offensive. But I hope they are. Sometimes they use the phrase uplit, you know, I hope it is uplifting, hopeful, and sometimes very sad, but also sometimes I always hoped I would make someone laugh on the bus on their way to work. That's what I hope they might do in places as well, really.
One of the other things that I had not really thought about, but I did after reading your books, was letter writing and how it might be becoming a lost art, but you kind of show how important letters can be in someone's life. Can you talk about the role of letters in your books and why we should all turn off our email and start writing to each other with pen and paper?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I collect lots of original letters from the war era. And part of that is because it gives you a real insight into people's lives. And for Mrs. Porter Calling, where Charles, Emmy's husband, is away fighting, I collected quite a few letters from servicemen writing home, and obviously they couldn't, the censor stopped them writing anything of any kind of information about where they were or what they were doing, but it was their interest in the minutiae of home. You know, has little Betty got her new shoes, or oh, please give my best to Uncle Barry, or whatever, and really trying to still be in touch with all the normal stuff at home that they were fighting for. And so those letters are both informative and also inspiring, because for some reason or another, and quite often they have ended up on eBay or in a junk shop or that sort of thing. There's a pathos to that, because for 80 plus years, someone has kept those in a suitcase in their attic or in a drawer. And at some point, particularly the love letters, you know, they would have been an absolute lifeline to people. And now, I mean, in 80 years' time, are we going to say to someone's great niece or great great nephew, oh, let me show you a text at your granddad? I mean, it's just not going to happen. And I have postcards. When my dad used to work away a bit when I was little, and he used to send me postcards quite often of boring pictures of motorways and bridges, because he wasn't working anywhere glamorous. But I treasure those, and I still have them, and they are all they will say is, dear Mandy, I'm coming home on Monday, love Daddy. And in the days before any kind of mobile communications, that was so exciting to get a postcard from your dad when you were five or six. And I mean, they don't mean anything to anyone else, but I think they're wonderful. And you can't keep texts and emails. You can print them off, but, you know, it's not romantic or sweet. It's kind of, you print off emails from work if you're an old person like me, obviously. No one else has them in the cloud. But I think letters and ink pens. Look, this, I've just got a new fountain pen. Uh-huh. I had a half hour conversation with my father on Skype at the weekend about vintage fountain pens. Neither of us had been happier ever to talking about that. So what a lovely thing to get to do with your 93-year-old dad.
Are old pens better than new pens?
Well, okay, pen nerds. I'm I'm an amateur in this, but this is a 1948 Swan Maybe Todd. And I like to sign books with this if I'm signing Tippins papers to go in books, because I kind of think, how cool, who's written with this pen in the last 75 years or so? What has this pen seen? What desks has it sat on? What and so old pens are great, but they don't leave the house. So new pens can be replaced. I'm sorry, this probably isn't why anybody tuned in to hear me talk about my stationery habit.
Well, speaking of writing habits, you had written something or had said something in an interview that I thought was really interesting about the writing process. And let me look at it to make sure I get it correct. When it comes to writing to be successful, you need three things: passion, patience, and persistence. First of all, you get points for alliteration, but can you tell us a little bit about this, your philosophy?
Yes, well, passion, you absolutely need it, because it takes forever to write these things. And I can absolutely guarantee that even if you love your book to start with, deep into the third round of edits or the copy edits or suddenly realizing you've not researched something properly on page 250, there will be boring, gloomy, dreary times. So if you don't love it at the start, the thousands of hours you're spending on this are going to be miserable. So for a start, that just makes sense. I don't think it's worth doing anything for very long if you're not passionate about it. You may as well just get a boring job somewhere and hate it and take the money. You know, I mean, writing books is risky. It doesn't always lead to being published or to being paid for it. So write what you love, and then your process would have been exciting and I hope at points joyful. So the passion, I think, should be there. And then persistence, you do have to keep going. And there are times when you just think, It could be you've had lots of rejections from agents or publishers. And other times, and this happened with my current book, with Mrs. Porter Calling, I'd written about 40,000 words and I realized the plot didn't work, that what I was writing, Emmy, my main character, just didn't care enough about the story I'd given her. And that's always my check, will Emmy care? And so I ditched pretty much 40,000 words of it. So you do need to be very persistent. You need to just, whatever happens, I'll keep going. And then patience, because it does take a long time, and finding an agent and finding a publisher if you're lucky, and then getting published, it all takes a long old time. And patience is, you know, if you know it's going to take a long time, and you know it might take you a year to write the book that you want to write, it might take you 10 years, then that's okay. That, and also, I think one of the other great things about writing is that it's one of the few industries where there you can start at 50 or 70 or 90. And no one, if you've written a good enough book, people won't say, you know, oh, you're too old for this. And you can see with lots of debut writers that are in their, you know, later life, as somebody said to me, I nearly punched them, honestly. I was a lit fest. I was 54 and I saw it. AJ Pearce will be talking about writing in later life. It wasn't good for morale at all.
And it's especially odd because now people are living longer, so you're not even really in the latter part of your life. You're kind of in the early years, but what can you do?
What can you do?
Let's talk about your own writing process, because you're now in the third book that carries a character through different stories. When you first started out, did you think, I want to do this as a continuation? Did you find now in book three that there are things you wish you had done back in book one? What is it? I mean, each book stands alone. You can read each book on its own, but there has to be a connective tissue. How do you do that as a writer?
I think the making sure the books stand alone on their own is really important, because when I wrote the first one, I always thought, gosh, I'd love to follow Emmy throughout the entire war and follow her growing up. I'd love to do that. And I've been lucky enough that I am doing that. But equally, I'm a reader, and there's always that excitement at a train station or the airport. You see an interesting cover, or you feel that your stack of books for your holiday reading isn't quite huge enough, so you grab one that looks good. And I feel really, really strongly that if someone picks up one of the books and it's the first one they've read, it has to be decent on its own. Otherwise, you've swizzed them. It's not fair. So that's where I start. But also in terms of the series, it's lovely to bring characters back. There's a character comes in Mrs. Porter Calling who was in Dear Mrs. Bird, and it's a character that I loved, and they didn't get much screen time, as it were. And I always wanted to bring them back, and I always knew I would if I was lucky enough to write more books. So I have loved bringing them back in Mrs. Porter Calling. And there's a new character. Sometimes it's quite often the small ones. There's a chap called Horace Batley Norris who
is. I love him.
Oh, great! Thank you. I'm so pleased. Horace is a genius, mm-hmm. And he is in one chapter, and he works at the ministry in horticulture. And he was just needed for a scene. And then it was my favorite scene to write in the whole book. And he just comes through as this wonderful man I'd love to give him his own book, actually. He's just, there's so much that's interesting about him, I think. And so sometimes you get these lovely presents almost. It's a gift that you go, oh, Horace, where did you come from? You're brilliant. I love you. What can we do with Horace? So yes, and you occasionally, I do look back. I was speaking to someone just this week, actually, saying, oh, I wish I'd put so-and-so in a bit more, because they were a good character, and I'd have liked to have done more with them. So with a series, you do often get the chance to give someone a bigger role later, or in yours, cheerfully, the little girl Ruby, who was only supposed to be in it for one chapter, ended up taking over the whole book because she was fun to write. So sometimes it just, if you're lucky, it just takes over and characters appear and go, you know, hey, actually, I've got more to say than you thought I did. So I try to give them their time, and if they don't fit into this series, then I may do some spin-offs, or even if they're short stories or that sort of thing, just for, I might not publish them, but they would be, just give, you know, find out, why was Mrs. Bird like, why was Mrs. Bird a dragon? I know why she's a dragon, but particularly because the books are written in the first person, we don't always get to know their backstory well enough, which could be poor writing, but I'm putting it down to the fact that it's Emmy's story, so we see it from her point of view.
Yeah, I think they often say that every villain is the hero of their own story or her own story. So getting to see it from their viewpoint sometimes changes things.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So, but yes, writing a series, it was a hope, and I'm so pleased that I've been able to do it, because it's lovely watching Emmy and Bunty grow and see Guy Collins come back and find out more about him and let him, everyone see his warmth, and he's one of my favorite characters, and see people get to know him and find out more about him. That's been lovely.
And we do have some comments and questions from your many viewers, so we probably should throw a few of those in before we run out of time. Someone has mentioned that they enjoyed your knowledge of stationery and pens because it adds to the story. They want to know, were they hard to get? Was pens and stationery hard to get during the war years in England? Because we take that for granted.
Yes, I mean, everything was. And particularly, I mean, if you look at a pen, all the parts of it that are needed, whether it's the metal bits or the, it isn't plastic, but the other stuff that would all have gone into making, whether it's bullets or casements or whatever else it was, and paper, huge shortages of that. So when you look at the old magazines, the ones that are pre-war are quite fat, lots of colour in them, lots of photos and pictures. And then by 1943-44, the typeface is smaller, the pictures are smaller, and they are cramming everything in, because instead of being a, I don't know, 32-page magazine, or it's now an 8-page magazine. So yes, everything over here at least was in very short supply. And that's why actually it's amazing that these magazines have lasted, because you were supposed to recycle them.
Another person wanted to know, what kind of a reader were you? Do you read the same kind of books that you write, or are you a secret horror reader?
That would be weird, wouldn't it? I like to read. I read quite a lot of books written in the 30s and 40s. D.E. Stevenson, I'm a huge fan of. Angela Thirkell, and lots of little known now writers, and ones that are published. We have a publishing company over here called Persephone Books, who find old, perhaps slightly forgotten books and republish them, and I love discovering those. And I try, this is a shameless plug I might add, for I have a newsletter, and I usually put 3 or 4 book recommendations in there, and I try to put in old books that perhaps I've just found, or ones that have been republished, because it's lovely to kind of go back and read books that were written, you know, the best part of 100 years ago. And I like their lightness, the social comedies, which occasionally, the ones set in the war particularly, have a line or two that makes you pause and think, and then they go back to being very light. I mean, I should also say that when, for anyone looking into getting into sort of older books for the first time, some of the attitudes can be pretty grim. Mm-hmm. I mean, social, it might be a light social comedy, and then a word or a phrase or an attitude brings you up sharp. But it's always interesting to know the historical context. And then I the books I read now that might be contemporary books, they're generally all sort of, you know, pretty hopeful, cheery books.
That's great. Another person wanted to know this kind of, I guess, would be a broader question you could answer. They want to know if you're going to bring a particular character, Charles, back again. And I guess that would tie into what are your future plans as an author. And I know some authors don't like to talk about their works in progress, so we'll leave that up to you.
Oh, thank you. Yes, Charles is away fighting at the moment, and I know a lot of readers are concerned about whether he will be coming home from his military service. So that will be something that we'll find out, I hope, at some point. And I can't say any more than that. But yes, I know Charles is a really popular character, and I do listen to what everyone says as well, and oh, is so-and-so going to end up with so-and-so, and what about them? And so some I know what's going to happen to them, and others I haven't quite decided. So, and I try to write as if I don't know, so if so that I can write in the moment, and I'm not thinking, oh, this person's going to get hit by a bus in the next chapter. I try not to think about that. So yes, and I would, as I say, I'd love to do some spin-off writing, whether or not that would just be short stories or novellas. Clarence the Postboy, I'm slightly in love with Clarence the Postboy. He's in every book, and I gave him a key part of the plot at the end of Dear Mrs. Bird. I made him carry a post bag, which was absolutely critical to the plot, because I didn't want an editor to tell me he wasn't necessary. So I gave him something to do to keep him in the book. So yeah, I hope that answers that question.
That does, I think. Another of your fans wanted to know, is there any hope that we might see Emmy on the big or small screen? And who do we need to write to at the BBC to see this happen?
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? There are no plans at the moment, but I would love, I mean, obviously any author would say this, but I would love to see a Sunday night. We have Sunday night TV series. Sunday nights are always lovely drama series over here, and antiques programs and nice dramas. So that would be the dream. So I don't know. I hope perhaps one day someone will discover the series and want to make it into a series. And I should say that there's a scene in Yours Cheerfully, which is at Waterloo Station, one of the big stations in London. And I wrote that so that as many of us as possible can be extras if it's ever made into a TV series or film. Because I thought, if I write a scene where there are tons of people, they're going to need extras. So, I mean, it is an important scene. I should add, it isn't just this weird thing with a crowd, but yeah, wouldn't that be lovely? That is a bit of a dream. I hope perhaps one day it'll come true. So write to, I don't know, the head of, well, don't write to anyone, actually, because the writer's strike is on. So no, let's not do anything.
Wait.
Not until that's sorted, yeah.
Another one of your readers wanted to know, you've read through so many years and decades worth of advice columns. What piece of advice surprised you the most?
That's such a good question. I think, I mean, there are some that are pretty grim because of the time they were in. They're always kind of, ooh. But one of the ones that surprised me and did make me smile, I have to admit, was, and I put this into Yours Cheerfully, was a young woman wrote in, and she'd been to the cinema, and the bloke sitting next to her had been completely out of order and wouldn't leave her alone and spoil her day completely. And the magazine said, well, carry a knitting needle in your bag or a lit cigarette, which is terrible. This is health and safety. Please do not take this as advice for legal reasons or anything. Do not do this. But that surprised me, that and it did make me laugh. We would never suggest that now, but at the time they were kind of, well, jabbing with a knitting needle, which was I hadn't realized they'd be quite so forceful. But don't, please don't do it. I don't want any kind of litigation.
I think it is historical, but not contemporary advice.
Absolutely.
You have a background in marketing. Has that helped you as a writer? Do you find yourself saying, I think we should be doing this? Or do you just completely divorce yourself from the process?
My publishers are brilliant. I mean, they are so patient because I find I'm a bit of a marketing nerd. I'm really interested in it. I'm the sort of person when they put a new wrapper on a chocolate, I find it interesting. And so I'm always interested in the process. And I think actually now writers have to be for themselves, whether it's their social media activity or whether they're thinking of sharing their content, whether it's on Substack or any other sort of platform. I kind of think that for most of us jobbing authors, you can't just sit here in an ivory tower writing. You kind of have to be aware of opportunities and what you're doing. And I was encouraged. I saw a documentary the other day on David Bowie. I'm not putting any of the stuff I do anywhere near that in terms of him, but the most creative, one of the most creative people that Britain has ever, the world has ever seen. And I saw that him saying, you know, he was asked about why he was such a good businessman. And he said, well, when I'm creating, I am 100% a creator and in my creative area. But let me tell you that when I'm talking about business, I know what I'm talking about. I'm paraphrasing. But I thought, wow, that's really impressive that even someone who was an absolute creative genius is able to sort of say, okay, that's me doing that. And then when I'm talking about my business, I can do that as well. So I think that's something that as writers, it's our job and it's our profession. And we shouldn't shy away from the fact that we want people to read our stuff. And we not all of us, but you know, if you want to be a commercial writer, why not be interested in the marketing side? So yeah, I'm always interested in what people are doing and people who are independently published or self-published. There's tons you can learn from that. So I'm hoping, even though I'm increasingly ancient, I'm hoping I can still learn about how to do all this.
Well, I would disagree that you're not in the latter part of your life. You're still in the springtime of your life. So we hope for many more books from you. Before we run out of time, can you let readers know how they can find out more about you and your books? Are you on social media? You mentioned a newsletter. Do you have a website?
Yes. Oh, thank you. It would be lovely if people want to find me. I am AJ Pierce Writes, mostly on Instagram and Facebook. I'm also ajpierce.com, which is where you can find a sign up form to the newsletter. I've got one going out tomorrow, actually. It's a monthly newsletter and it's full of jollies and chats and talking about books and writing. So you can find me there or just come and say hello on Instagram or Facebook. And that would be lovely to meet you there.
I can't believe how quickly our time has flown by. The Poison Pen has been hosting author AJ Pierce, whose new book is Mrs. Porter Calling. It's the third in a truly remarkable and wonderful series. I like to think of them kind of as a balm to the weary reader's soul. I'd like to thank AJ for taking time to visit with us and thank all of you for tuning in to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely. And thank you to everyone for tuning in. I really appreciate it. This has been lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.